2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 21, Gold Rush Saints, the Contest Between Babylon and Zion in California's New El Dorado, a paper by Ken Owens with a response by Edward Leo Lyman.
Emeritus of History at California State University, Sacramento. He's a specialist in the early American West. He also is a founder of CSUS's Capital Campus Public History Program. In addition to his Gold Rush Saints, he has published works on John Sutter, The Social History of the California Gold Rush, Fly Fishing in the West, and The History of Russian America, his newest research interest. He and his wife Sally, also retired from CSUS, make their home in Sacramento. Our respondent today will be Edward Leo Lyman, who is a professor of history at Victor Valley College. He received his PhD from the University of California, Riverside in history. He is currently, he's the editor, co-editor of No Place to Call Home, the 1807-1857 Life Writings of Caroline Barnes Crosby, Chronicler of Outlying Mormon Communities. So first we'll hear from Ken and then Leo, and then we'll go ahead and take questions from the audience. So, Ken.
Thank you, Dylan. As Dylan told you, for many years I was teaching at Cal State University Sacramento Western history, and I also developed a graduate program in public history. And it was that program that was the door by which I entered into the study of the Mormon experience during the California Gold Rush. Many, many years ago, in large part to make work for my graduate students, I took a contract with the U.S. Forest Service to do a site study of what was then called the Mormon Immigrant Trail, the trail that runs across Carson Pass, the large part of it through El Dorado National Forest. I was fortunate in working on that study to have the assistance of a general cadre of fine graduate students, but principal among them, Mike Landon, who I'm sure some of you know, now an archivist with the Church History Department in Salt Lake City. Mike was doing his graduate work and looking for a career, and he dug into the study of the Mormon Immigrant Trail, helping me particularly with the opening of the trail by a party of principally Mormon battalion veterans who were returning from the gold fields after the earliest discoveries and heading for the new colony established, of course, at Salt Lake City under Brigham Young's direction. It was Mike that introduced me to Dave Bigler, who is another amazing historian. And through Mike and Dave, I got acquainted with Will Bagley. And somehow, between this grouping, I was persuaded in time, many years after the original study had been completed, the Mormons didn't stay around as an official organized group. The church officially ended its presence in California in 1856 and 1857 when Brigham Young recalled the California Mormons at the time of the Utah War. More about the reasons for this recall later. And curiously enough, or so it seemed to me, for the next 30 years, while the church was sending missionaries far and wide throughout the Pacific, throughout Europe, all around the world, they did not have any activity whatsoever in California. Not during Brigham Young's lifetime and not during the lifetime of his two successors. It was only after, during Wilford Woodruff's presidency, that the church then began to renew its presence in California. There were no Mormons around when California's history was first definitively being written, and so the California historians overlooked the Mormon presence during the Gold Rush era. Moreover, Mormon history, as I'm sure some of you will agree with me, has by and large been written from the point of view of Salt Lake City, what I have termed a Zion-centric point of view, a perspective. And the California experience simply did not fit into the Zion-centric perspective. There was nothing very instructive for the propagation of the faith in the California Mormon experience. And so the earliest Mormon historians also slighted the story of the Northern California Gold Rush Saints. They simply followed the lead of the well-known California pioneer historian, Hubert Howe Bancroft. Took the little bit that Bancroft had to say, and what was most indicative, Bancroft ended his account of the Mormon presence in the fall of 1848, when the first group of battalion veterans did open up this trail across the Sierra. Not only did the veterans, a group of them, go back to Salt Lake City, but so far as Bancroft was concerned, all the Mormons disappeared from that point forward in California. And as I said, the Mormon historians were content to follow Bancroft's lead. Well, for all of these reasons, and because I like untold stories, I got successively involved with Mike's continued assistance, with Will's and Dave's continued assistance, in finding the documents, an amazing abundance of documents that no one had really looked at before, to help me put this whole story together. After my retirement from active teaching 5 years ago, no longer facing great piles of blue books and graduate theses on my desk, I was able to settle down and get the account finished. And the result is this book, Gold Rush Saints, which is the latest volume in Will Bagley's series, Kingdom of the West. What I'd like to do this morning is tell you a bit about that story of the Gold Rush Saints. It's a large and very complex story, and I've got to move through it in a hurry. All I can say is, for more. I know that all good LDS people are readers. For more, get the book, read the book. And you will find copies on sale down the hall here at a reasonable discount. Now, my title, The Contest Between Babylon and Zion in California's New El Dorado. That's got some buzzwords in it to attract you here. And perhaps it misrepresents the case a little bit. From one point of view, Brigham Young and the Salt Lake City hierarchy did develop a sense of growing antipathy toward California and the California experience, and especially to what was happening to good saints who went to California and were, as Young came to believe, progressively corrupted by the society in California during the Gold Rush era. There was a contest of values and allegiances, more important in my point of view, between the Gold Country secular Babylon and the LDS Zion. But that contest was not simply a contest between Mormons and non-Mormons in the Gold Country. It was a contest going on within the Mormon community itself, or the Mormon church members that didn't form for quite a while a cohesive, well-organized community under church direction. Perhaps most interesting to this audience, we can see that a good many LDS gold seekers sought in California to reconcile their Mormonism with the life in the Gold Country. In the process, they established what I take to be an alternative model of Mormonism, separate from and more than a little at odds with the disciplined, centralized, theocratic system being developed by Brigham Young and his associates in the Great Basin. Indeed, for some church members who came to feel uncomfortable with church discipline and with all the church doctrines, including especially the doctrine of plural marriage, Northern California during the 1850s apparently came to offer a spiritual halfway house, halfway between observant LDS allegiance under tight church control and, on the other hand, outright apostasy. As I say somewhere in the book, in one sense, California came to serve a safety valve function for some Great Basin Mormons who, I'm trying to think of a phrase, of course, were galled by, were unwilling to submit to the total church discipline, or were uncomfortable for one reason or another, many different reasons, with the leadership in Salt Lake City. Instead of disappearing entirely from the church rolls, they went to California and participated with other Mormons in California. In other words, California Mormonism, at the start, even at the start, we might say, was different from Utah Mormonism. No great secret to this audience, I'm sure. The Northern California faithful exhibited a degree of independence that often set them apart from their friends and relatives and co-religionists living in the shadow of the Wasatch, and who more or less strictly adhered to President Young's church-dominated community ideals, including its expectation in Utah for the second coming and the near-term end of earthly time. As I said, the story is a complex one, and for brevity's sake, I need to start some little distance into the narrative, briefly mentioning matters that I trust are mostly familiar to this audience. During the mid-1840s, while the main body of LDS faithful began moving westward from Nauvoo, two groups started directly to California at Brigham Young's urging. First came the Brooklyn Saints, who sailed from the East Coast to San Francisco Bay in 1846, arriving soon after the outbreak of the Mexican War and the conquest of San Francisco by the U.S. Navy. Second came the Mormon Battalion, part of General Colonel Kearney's Army of the West, which marched overland from winter quarters first to Santa Fe, then onward across Arizona to arrive at Los Angeles and San Diego in January 1847. For good reason, I want to emphasize, for good reason, both groups believed originally that President Young would be bringing the main body of the church to join them on the West Coast. That fact does a great deal to explain especially the dynamics of Brigham Young's subsequent relationship with Samuel Brannan, the leader of the Brooklyn Saints. When Brannan learned that the church was heading westward from winter quarters, he was sincere in the conviction that he would be doing the right thing by heading eastward to meet the Pioneer Party and guide Young's colony to San Francisco Bay, where he and his colleagues had turned that infant settlement into what was really a Mormon trading town. He found the church leadership at the Green River Crossing in modern Wyoming. After accompanying Young to the future site of Salt Lake City, he argued vehemently against Young's decision to stop and settle there. The intensity of the argument, let me suggest, is the context for one of the most famous founding scenes in the early history of the church in the West. July 28, 1847, Brigham Young assembled a general congregation where Temple Square would be located. Cutting off further controversy, the church president struck the ground with his cane and proclaimed that this would be the spot, a moment memorialized, of course, by the bronze statue of Young that still stands alongside Temple Square. It's been moved a few times, as some of you. Without a dissenting voice, although Brannan was standing close by, the saints passed a motion to, quote, locate in this valley for the present and lay out a city at this place. According to one later report, Young then turned to Brannan and declared, we have no business in San Francisco. The Gentiles will be there pretty soon. The heat of the argument between Young and Brannan is emphasized in the recollections of another well-placed witness. Remember that Brannan saw at the Salt Lake City site, he wrote, desolation and I'm going to build a temple here. I am going to build a country. His stubborn determination, all will agree, was one of President Young. Even after he returned, here is the testimony from Hammond's autobiography. Hawaii about the evil Mormons that had turned up on the West Coast. But that is, of course, another. His experience. Brother Brannan was not blessed at this time with much wealth, although in a few months from this period he would be a very wealthy man. Real estate, which at this time was very low in San Francisco. City lots could be purchased from $100 to $50 per, from $10 to $50 per lot. That is, out on the sand hills, and in the business portion, they could be bought from $100 to $250. I told Brother Brannan that I did not feel it my duty to remain here and go into speculations, that I had agreed to start for Salt Lake with the company in July and gather with the heads of the church. He did all he could to dissuade me from my purpose, intimating that the church would be obliged to abandon the desert country where they had settled and immigrate to California, for he did not believe that they could sustain themselves in the Rocky Mountains. Therefore, what a nice thing it would be for me to invest in real estate and have some to sell when the immigrants should come. Thus was I tempted to remain in that land and wait for the church to come to me. The Lord blessed me, however, with great desire to gather with the people of God who had been driven many times from their homes among Christians and now had been led by the inspiration of the Lord and his prophet Brigham to pitch their tents in the midst of the Rocky Mountains, as far removed as possible from their former Christian neighbors and red-hot persecutors, where they could live in peace in the midst of hostile Indians rather than among so-called Christians. I'd like to turn now to the second group of saints in California, the veterans of the Mormon Battalion, or the Battalion Boys, as they often called themselves, and the start of the Gold Rush. About 330 battalion members reached California. With them came a very few wives. After months of garrison duty, they were discharged at Los Angeles in July of 1847. Immediately, most of them set out to find their family and friends with the main body of the church. The largest group of veterans marched northward through the hot summer in the San Joaquin Valley, and they arrived on the McCollumy River in late August, where they made camp. They intended to head east, crossing the Sierra Nevada into the Great Basin by the Donner Pass route, then the only well-known trail over the mountains. While they were camped, a messenger brought word that Brigham Young's pioneer party of Nauvoo refugees had reached Salt Lake. The main body of saints was expected there by the end of the summer, this report continued, and the Salt Lake Valley was the place where the church would stay. With this news, the veterans moved northward to the American River, camped 2 miles from Sutter's Fort, and paused to consider their options. Short of funds, many of the men found themselves lacking the provisions, the equipment, and the animals necessary for the trip across the Sierra. This group, 40 to 60 of the veterans, according to the later statement of James S. Brown, favored remaining in Northern California to replenish their supplies. They appointed a committee to approach John Sutter with an offer to work for him. The committee, Brown recalled, informed Mr. Sutter that we had carpenters, blacksmiths, wheelwrights, millwrights, farmers, and common laborers, and that we should want horses, cattle, and a general outfit for crossing the plains early the next summer. And if we could not get all money, we could and would take part of our pay in the above-mentioned stock and supplies. For his part, Sutter thought that these people were sent by whatever gods that he worshipped. He was hoping to begin 2 major construction projects, including a sawmill in the foothills at Coloma on the South Fork of the American River. These were all still vague plans. Sutter liked the conditions stated by the veterans. As Brown recalled, as he had an abundance of the above-mentioned property, and the greatest obstacle that confronted him had been removed by the propositions that our committee had made to him. The day after this committee visited him, John Sutter signed the partnership contract with James Marshall to begin the project at Coloma, where gold would be discovered the following January. The remaining veterans left their brethren at Sutter's Fort and started east, only to meet at Truckee Meadows, the site of Reno now, Sam Brannan and a small company sent from Salt Lake, returning from Salt Lake with the message, with a message for them from President Young. Unless they had dependent family members waiting for them, Young advised, they should remain in California, work through the winter, and then come next season, since it would be difficult to support in Salt Lake, to support them through the winter in the straitened condition, the real starving times at Salt Lake City that fall and winter. They should bring with them when they came all the supplies, tools, and seeds they could to assist the infant Zion colony. And so, all unintentionally, Brigham Young sent back to John Sutter the workers who would carry out his projects, with results, of course, then unimagined. This becomes a prime example of the law of unintended consequences in history. Very soon, Sutter was bragging about the accomplishments of his LDS workmen. In mid-October, he wrote that both the sawmill and the large flour mill would be finished in a month or two, always the optimist, because of the skilled labor of the battalion boys. The Mormons, he wrote, are the best workers as I have. Without them, the mills could not be made. Explain further. I have two tannery workers and three shoemakers, Mormons. All the hands on my mills are Mormons, and they are the best people which ever I has had employed. Sutter compared his new workers with the other non-native employees he had hired in the past. If I would have had Mormons 4 or 5 years past, he said, I would have a fortune. But so long as I am here, I has had only a few good men. The balance has been a bad kind of people. The battalion veterans, working for Sutter's promises, now appeared to be the long-standing solution for his financial problem. While we have no evidence that he ever reflected on the reason for his good fortune, Sutter was not a reflective person. Captain Sutter might well have thanked Brigham Young for sending him the men he needed to make New Helvetia profitable at last. Quote, I hope now that when this gristmill, sawmill, and tannery are going well on, so he wrote to his friend Thomas Larkin, I will soon be out of my difficulties. Then came the Coloma gold discovery, and for Sutter and for the Saints, everything changed. The story of the gold discovery at Coloma in January 1848 is, in general, a familiar one. My account in Gold Rush Saints refocuses the narrative to give proper attention to the whole small community at Coloma at the time of the first discovery. Prominent were 8 Mormon battalion veterans, all fairly young, single, and working under the direction of 38-year-old single James Marshall, who was Sutter's partner in the sawmill enterprise. Marshall's account combines well with the testimony of battalion veterans Henry Bigler and James S. Brown, as well as the fragmentary evidence in Azariah Smith's journal. This is not the place to tell the gold discovery story with all of its details, but let me summarize a couple salient points. In contrast to the traditional myth-reinforced story in which Sutter and Marshall appear as chosen agents of manifest destiny to carry forward the inevitable progress of American people, the autobiographical narrative of the LDS participants makes clear that the Coloma gold discovery was a peculiar historical accident. Contingent on a unique alignment of circumstances, within Northern California's remote frontier borderland, John Sutter, James Marshall, and the Coloma Native people were involved, all each with their separate motives and concerns. But the circumstances converged because Sutter had been able to enlist from among the Mormon battalion veterans a skilled labor force who would work on account, willing to trust Captain Sutter's recklessly optimistic pledge of future payments. With Brigham Young's prompting, these men had turned back to California with a two-part agenda. They had a temporary need to make a living, and they were determined to travel to the Great Basin the following summer, as Brigham Young urged. There is, as I said earlier, no better textbook example of the accidental factor in history, or the law of unintended consequences. Skipping over the details for now, I'll simply put before you the conclusion stated by James S. Brown in his 1894 published reminiscences of the gold discovery. To Sutter's capital and enterprise, Brown wrote, and Marshall's shrewd sagacity has been given the credit of the great gold discovery of California. The facts are, James W. Marshall discovered the first color, and in less than an hour, 6 Mormons found color as well. And in less than 6 weeks, They had discovered it in hundreds of places that Mr. Marshall had never seen, the most notable of which was Mormon Island, to where the first rush was made. And this is a point I'll return to emphasize. James Brown was absolutely right. To where the first gold rush was made, that's Mormon Island. And from where the news was spread to the uttermost bounds of the everlasting hills and to all the nations of the earth. As to Sutter's enterprise and capital, he did furnish the Graham flour and the mutton, wheat and peas, black coffee, brown sugar, teams and tools, while we, the members of the Mormon battalion, did the hard labor that discovered the metal. And it's also true that we were in Sutter's employ at that date and that we did not get paid for our labor. I worked 100 days for the firm and never received one farthing for it. I heard a number of other men say they never got their pay. Then it was our labor that developed the find and not theirs, for many of them were never paid. And when we went for settlement, we were told by Captain Sutter that he could not settle for us, for his bookkeeper had gone to the mines. He declared he was a ruined man, that the discovery was his ruin, for it had drawn off his labors and left everything to go to rack, and he was being robbed. I do not wish to be understood to charge them with being dishonorable, said Mr. Brown. For I do not, but I charge it to the general confusion of the country. He's being very gracious. I think they were honorable men in a business way, but the facts are that they were perfectly overrun with all classes of people and confused, so that the people took advantage of them. And their business affairs were undermined, and there was a general collapse of every industry. The cry was gold, gold, more gold, away from the gold fields. Every other enterprise was sacrificed at the sight of gold. With all due respect to Captain John A. Sutter and James W. Marshall, to whom the world has given the credit of the great find, I do believe if they had been taken out and shot to death the day of the discovery, they would have suffered less and would have met their maker just as pure, if not more honored in this world, than to have lived and endured what they did. Brown's mention of Mormon Island directs us to the next chapter in the Gold Rush story. After Marshall's original discovery at the Coloma Mill site, battalion veteran Henry Bigler, over the next few weeks, took the lead in finding other locations downriver that produced bits and pieces of pure placer gold. These discoveries led directly to a prospecting expedition carried out by three of Bigler's friends, who made a major discovery on the South Fork of the American River site, on the American River, at a site halfway between Coloma and Sutter's Fort, the site that came to be called Mormon Island. Throughout the spring of 1848, while James Marshall and John Sutter were still attempting to keep news of the Coloma discovery from spreading, small groups of battalion boys mining at Mormon Island, which is now submerged beneath Folsom Lake, found gold more easily and in richer concentrations than the Coloma site would ever produce. It was the news from Mormon Island, not Coloma, that attracted Samuel Brannan to investigate. And it was Mormon Island's placer deposits that prompted Brannan's famous walk through the streets of San Francisco, waving a sample of Mormon Island gold in a quinine bottle and yelling to all, "Gold, gold, gold from the American River," the event that some authors take to mark the true beginning of the California Gold Rush as a world event. At Mormon Island, increasing numbers of Mormon battalion veterans, a good many of the Brooklyn Saints, worked through the spring and early summer of 1848 with quite satisfying results. You should realize that the average California rate of pay had been around $1.50 a day, which is what Sutter had promised to pay, at least in trade equivalents, to the Mormon battalion veterans. But these inexperienced LDS miners with the most primitive technology were able to realize immense returns for their hard labor in the gravel deposits, Mormon Island. Zadok Jug, for one, explains why wages were counted at about $100 a day there. Despite these astonishing returns, the battalion veterans remained focused, for the most part, on rejoining the main body of the church under Brigham Young. Some of the Brooklyn Saints were intent on making the trip as well. Their mining experience was more than a diversion. It provided them with the means to put together their traveling outfits and start the journey eastward with a sense of prosperity. By the end of June, Mormon Island and the Totumas diggings nearby had drawn nearly all of the California Saints, both Brooklyn Saints and the Mormon Battalion veterans spread around California before the news reached them of the Mormon Island diggings. Working for a month or two, or in some cases just for a few weeks, they became gold rich, according to their lights. They were the first successful fortune seekers in the Northern California placer diggings. And yet, as Henry Bigler subsequently wrote, where Mormon miners got $1 in the gold fields in 1848, other more experienced miners could later get hundreds. The significance of Mormon Island experience is huge. This was the true beginning of the California gold rush. It was the beginning of the mining industry in the American West. It was also a source of wealth for those who returned to Salt Lake that came into the economy of the infant Zion colony, some of which, as tithing, went directly to Brigham Young and the church hierarchy. In a story that Leonard Arrington has told, it became the basis of Salt Lake City's own coinage system, newly minted gold pieces, the gold from California that helped sustain the colony and its commerce in the starving time of those first couple years. And it was that source of gold from California that inspired Brigham at one time, while he was worrying about what happened to good Mormons in California, to send a gold mission. A couple parties go back to California. Some of them experienced miners like Henry Bigler, to mine on shares, being supported by some of the older, well-established members of the inner circle of the church, an experience that didn't work out very well. Gold missionaries were not, by and large, very successful. The boom days of 1848 did not hold up for them in 1849 and 1850. But Brigham was trying to have it both ways at this point. Get the resources of California gold, and on the other hand, keep the saints away from California. This was the great problem, and here I've got to summarize a whole lot, because time inevitably is fleeting. Everywhere the news of the gold discoveries in California came, it touched off what amounted to a social revolution. The youngest, most able, aggressive, energetic part of the population, predominantly the young men, but many of the women as well, simply lit out for California to make their fortune. That happened in Oregon, that happened in Hawaii, that happened in Peru, as the news first reached there, and soon it would happen worldwide. And that was exactly what concerned the church leadership in Salt Lake City. Brigham was horrified at the prospect that this wonderful place and this great experiment that he had underway would be ruined by the lure of California gold. He and his colleagues preached steadily against California. From the end of 1848, from the time that he first greeted the battalion veterans when they returned to Salt Lake, on through the 1850s. He preached against California, and in doing so, he was partly successful in keeping good Mormons from going to Salt Lake City. And that impressed him with the fact that those who were in California, those who went to California, and those who remained in California were not good members of the LDS Church. At the same time, the California Mormons, among other points that I've said in the introduction, did not adhere to the values of Salt Lake community, and especially there was a difference on the matter of plural marriage, polygamy. Polygamy, although there were a few church leaders came to California with plural wives, polygamy did not take root in California, either in Northern California, or as our commentator Leo Lyman has pointed out in his fine book on San Bernardino and the experience there, it did not take deep root in San Bernardino either. And this continued to be a dividing point between California Mormons and Salt Lake City Mormons. When the call came from Brigham Young in 1856 to call all of the saints to Salt Lake City to help defend against the incoming federal army, it was not simply a move for the defense of Utah and the church hierarchy. It offered an opportunity, one might even say a pretext, for President Young and his colleagues to close out the California experiments, both in the North and the South, about which they were increasingly unhappy. It was a justification for abandoning California in the way that California then stayed abandoned by the church leaders throughout the rest of Young's lifetime and for another two decades after that. I'm going to finish up now with just a short statement. I'm already running a minute or two over. But here's just an observation. President Young wrote in his message to the California Saints in 1847, before the gold was discovered, "Get rich, for the Lord designs that his should be the richest people on earth." Like the saints who joined the rush to California, he added, of course, "Use your riches to help the poor and the weak in the community and to help the church." Like the saints who joined the rush to California, Young and his associates in the Great Salt Lake Valley followed this dictum. They seized the economic main chance that the gold rush offered. They modified their policy of isolation, engaged with the wider world as represented by the immigrants coming through Salt Lake City, and they directed the LDS Church toward a far broader calling as the most successful Christian evangelical institution in modern American society. The issues of plural marriage and theocratic authority made the path of conciliation a rocky one. But the first steps were taken as a result of events in Northern California. And that, too, became part of the long-term service to their religion and to the Mormon people, rendered surely, if unwittingly, by the Gold Rush Saints in California. Okay.
Finally, we got a decent book on the Mormons in the Gold Rush. And it's been a long time coming. And the Arthur H. Clarke series has made great contributions, as has General Editor Will Bagley. It's mostly document collecting, but both the editor and his specific editors of the books, including Professor Owens, have been able to make more comments than most documentary histories do. The previous best book on California Gold Rush is Mormon Gold by Kenneth Davies, BYU econ professor, who knows economics very, very well, and did a wonderful job on Brigham's use of the gold for a Zion monetary system. But every time he went to make some conclusions based on historical facts, he went off in left field a dozen times. I know of very few books that I have less respect for than Mormon Gold. But it is the first attempt to tell the story, and he's told a lot of good things in it. It's just his extrapolations and what he calls hypotheses